Welcome back to Crossover Daily, SI's daily NBA podcast. I'm your host, Rohan Nadkarni. Today on the show, we'll be looking ahead to Game 4 of the NBA Finals. How will the Lakers adjust to the Heat's new defensive strategy? Can Jimmy Butler put together another big offensive game? And how could Bam Adebayo's return affect the series? Joining me will be Basketball News' Nikias Duncan. Let's start the show. All right, joining us now on Crossover Daily, he's one of my favorite NBA writers. For my money, I think he's one of the best in the world right now at breaking down film and showing you what's happening game to game. He currently writes for the Basketball News. Please welcome to Crossover Daily, Nikias Duncan. Nikias, how's it going, my man?
I'm doing much better after the introduction, man. How are you?
I'm telling you, man, every podcast, the introductions are where it peaks, and then my performance personally goes downhill from there. So there's a lot I want to get to. Obviously, the Heat pulled out a big win in Game 3 of the Finals. This series is a little bit more interesting now, and there are a few things I kind of want to touch on. I think the obvious story headed out of Game 3 was the night Jimmy Butler had offensively. He also played great on defense against LeBron, but you know, I don't think either of us expect him to put up 40-point triple-doubles routinely throughout the finals. Mm-hmm. You know, he did a great job, I think, of being aggressive in Game 3, particularly attacking switches. What did you see from him that you think is sustainable moving forward? I guess that's where I want to start. What are the parts of Jimmy's offensive game from Game 3 that you think he can continue doing in this series?
I think it's just the level of aggression. It definitely picked up in Game 2, and then it kind of carried over to Game 3, and the results kind of followed from there. But I think just his overall level of aggression was there. He attacked the paint a lot. He drove in isolation. As you mentioned, he did a great job of attacking switches, running a lot of high pick and rolls. The Lakers switched a lot more of those in the second half than they did in the first half, which was a little bit odd to me. But I think even without forcing switches, I think Jimmy has proven that he is a good enough driver, strong enough driver to kind of get into the paint. And from there, if it's a one-on-one situation, he knows how to angle his body and how to create space with his shoulder, with his lower body to kind of create that space necessary to get the shots up at the rim. And if they do send help, he's one of the best passers among wings in the NBA. He can kick it out and find those shooters. So I think him getting downhill is going to be there. As far as what's unsustainable, I felt like the most amount of jump shots that he's made in a game this season. Just so many turnarounds, fadeaway, right, little jump stops. And like, he has the floater, but the turnarounds that he was hitting in the post over Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, over Danny Green, I don't know how much you can bank on those shots. Those were the shots that just said Jimmy's cooking right now.
Right. No, that's a great point, because it's funny. I do think part of what helps him hit those shots is that he got himself into a rhythm earlier in the game than he normally does. Mm-hmm. But I agree. You know, I think there was one, he hit like a turnaround fadeaway over Kuzma, a turnaround fadeaway over Morris. You know, that's how you end up with the 14 out of 20 shooting night when basically all those shots are dropping as well. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the Lakers, what do you expect them to try to do to take that away? You know, we saw the Heat kind of hedge on LeBron, you know, let Jimmy recover on screens. I don't know that would be as effective for the Lakers because of the shooters Miami has. Is there anything you expect them to switch up defensively, though, to try to maybe take away Jimmy a little bit?
I think they're going to be a lot more intentional about ducking under his screens. That's a thing that the Lakers did in the first half and just kind of went away from it in the second half for whatever reason. Especially LeBron, he just kind of allowed Jimmy to dictate matchups in a way that was kind of odd. Especially since we saw LeBron like take on the Jamal Murray matchup in the Western Conference Finals and just kind of said, I'll guard him, whatever. I'm going to fight over screens, whatever I need to do. So for him to kind of just allow those switches as easily as he did, without even a hard screen, it was kind of odd to see. So I think that's going to be one thing that the Lakers point out on film. That's probably something LeBron's going to take more personally. They're going to stay attached to more matchups. So even if it is a one-on-one with Jimmy, it's going to be Jimmy against LeBron. And that is a tougher ask for Jimmy than a Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who's a good defender, but he's a little small. Markieff Morris, who has held up surprisingly well on the defensive end the last couple of rounds, but isn't the most mobile guy, isn't the guy you want guarding wings, you want to bang it with opposing fours. So I think it's going to be making sure kind of daring Jimmy to shoot by darting under those screens. I think that's going to be the big adjustment.
So let's take it one step further than that, you know, really make you put your coaching hat on here. Once the Lakers start going under those Jimmy screens, it is weird how teams treat Jimmy a little bit too conventionally. They respect his jump shot too much. We saw Boston get burned by that a few times in the conference finals. Now the Lakers last night. Do the Heat have a go-to counter when teams are going under Jimmy's screens?
I think if you're going to go under that, the obvious counter there is that you're giving Jimmy a little bit more space to kind of rev up the engine and drive if you're going to do that. So I think there are going to be some opportunities there where he can kind of get an extra step and get his body, gain some inside leverage on some of those drives. So that would probably help. And then that's also going to depend on who's setting the screen. Kelly Olynyk played a lot more in game 3 than we've seen in the other two games. If it's a pick and roll with him, if they're ducking under, Kelly Olynyk is really good at flipping the screen and kind of resetting his launch point there. Jimmy can kind of run the guy into the screen, and then from there, it's an uncomfortable switch because Kelly can just kind of do his little awkward bumping thing where it just looks like he doesn't know what he's doing, but then next thing you know, he's 4 feet from the basket and he's drawing a foul or getting a layup. Or if they're playing like a traditional drop coverage, then that's a pick and pop opportunity for Kelly Olynyk, who hasn't shot super well lately, but that's still not a shot you want him gaining rhythm on.
For sure. I do think Kelly, yes, he's turned more into a volume shooter than he wants to be, but if he were getting those looks, I think you'd see his percentages maybe come a little bit closer in line to where he was during the regular season. I want to ask you a little bit about the Heat's defensive adjustments. You know, I think the Heat, as great as Jimmy was offensively, offense hasn't really been the problem for them in the series. You know, they were 50-40-90 shooting percentages in game 2. It really was the defensive side of the ball where I think they slowed down the Lakers. I think I was looking it up. The Lakers had an offensive rating, you know, over 120 in the first two games. It was 104 in game 3. You know, I think the most obvious adjustment the Heat made was playing a lot less zone, a lot more man defense, not giving LeBron switches, basically taking that away entirely, you know, taking steps closer to the paint, kind of daring the Lakers shooters to win the game. I mean, Markieff Morris almost did, frankly. I think he was 5-11, which was pretty crazy for him. Let's start there. How sustainable is that for Miami moving forward? You know, how do you expect the Lakers to kind of respond to the way Miami tried to take away those switches on LeBron?
I think that's going to be the game plan, just making LeBron work a little bit harder in pick and roll. They don't want to give help those matchups. That's the thing that they did in games 1 and game 2. Did not execute those like hedge and recover sequences as well. And that kind of allowed LeBron to dictate the flow of the game. If he gets a mismatch, if he gets Tyler Hero on him, if he gets Duncan Robinson on him, he's going to bully those dudes with two dribbles. And if you don't send help, that's a layup or a dunk. And if you do send help, he's slinging passes everywhere. So I think in game 3, the numbers didn't really show that. I actually wrote about it in a piece that dropped today for Basketball News. The Lakers had an offensive rating of 180 points per 100 possessions when they did show on pick and rolls against LeBron. But it's just – it's the nature of – I mean, you have to make him work for it. I think that's kind of the lens that the Heat have to look at it towards. Like, you can't play pick and rolls 2-on-2 with LeBron. Like, he's just too good. He's too smart. So if you're going to go with 2, you're going to have to make him work as hard as possible. We also saw the Heat send, like, late double teams a little bit in the second half. Kind of what the Lakers did to the Rockets in the second round. They would let James Harden do his thing, let him dribble. Then once the shot clock hits 6 or 7, then they're sending a body because, you know, they don't have really any counters that late in the clock.
So no, that's a great point. And I was surprised the Heat weren't doing that a little bit more often in games 1 and 2, especially going into the series, knowing that the Lakers outside shooting was kind of maybe their most glaring weakness. Those doubles that the Lakers used against Houston were really effective. And I do think Miami started to get, you know, a little more risky when it comes to, you got to let Caruso try to beat you. You got to let KCP, Danny Green, Morris, Kuzma, you know, a couple of those guys went off last night. A couple of the other guys missed their shots. And I think that could be a difference in a game in this series. In that piece that you mentioned that you wrote this morning, I thought you also had a great breakdown of foul trouble aside, how the Heat were kind of making life difficult for Anthony Davis. You had a great example in there of basically the Heat are trying super hard to take away his right hand, you know, even when Anthony Davis is on you know, the left side of the floor. He's still often shooting with that right hand. It's what he likes to come back to. Andre Iguodala trying to shade him toward the baseline on this one possession. It's a really great breakdown. What can the Heat do, you know, without Bam to continue to give Anthony Davis trouble?
I think that's going to be it. Anthony Davis is a good passer for a big. He's not a great one. So I think double teams can still bother him if they're done in a timely and aggressive fashion. That was one of the big miscues in game one. The Heat would send some doubles to Anthony Davis, but they were kind of soft. Jay Crowder was definitely a culprit of that, just kind of lazily coming in for some double teams, and it just led to some swing sequences that gave the Lakers a lot of open looks. In game three, I feel like they were a lot more intentional about the way they were shading Anthony Davis, like you said and how I wrote. They want to get Anthony Davis away from his strong hand. They don't want him facing up and going to the middle of the floor, because from there he can kind of extend over folks. The Heat still don't have a lot of size. So Anthony Davis can get to that right hand, go to that jump hook, can flow into a pull-up jumper if he needs to, can dunk over people if he needs to. So I think it was smart that they, especially when he was on the left block, they would shade him to his left hand. If he did try to work right, then you'd have a guy kind of dropping down. Jimmy Butler was that guy on a lot of possessions when LeBron was about to break. Whoever was defending the guard above the break, they would kind of shade down, make sure Anthony Davis can get to the middle of the floor. So I think that's something they're going to continue to do. If Bam comes back and he's 80-85% of himself, then I think you can afford a little bit more single coverage just because Bam is that good of a defender. But I do think the principles of which way you want to shade him and forcing him into uncomfortable shots, like, I think that stays the same whether Bam comes back or not.
So that's really, you know, kind of the elephant in the room, so to speak, what's hanging over the series. I think I don't know anyone who expects Goran Dragic to play again. That just sounds like too serious of an injury to recover from. Bam listed as questionable for game four now. I think on the other hand, most people expect him to play. I was kind of surprised he didn't play in game three just because of what he'd been saying leading up to it. I'm going to be very surprised if he doesn't play in game four. What can Bam do for the Heat on both sides of the ball? On one hand, I think the Heat have found a weird alchemy on offense that works. I'm not saying that they are going to be somehow worse on that end if Bam returns. Mm-hmm. I do think something about having Kelly and Myers in there helps Jimmy a lot. Mm-hmm. How do you see a potential Bam return affecting the series on both sides of the floor?
I think just to kind of get to that point, obviously Bam is the best big that he'd have. I've been saying all year that Bam is Miami's best player. I don't know how much of a hot take that is.
But, you were prescient on that. That was you really looked into the crystal ball on that one. I hope you took a victory lap during the conference finals. I think he definitely was the best player on the floor in that Boston series. There's no question.
That he was. But I think just the spatial element that Kelly Olynyk and, to a lesser extent, Myers Leonard provides, that definitely opened up some space for Jimmy Butler to drive through. And if you put Bam back into the lineup, that's going to restrict that space a little bit. But the counter to that is that kind of also solidifies the backup center rotation. You know, especially earlier in the series, the Heat were kind of working with Andre Iguodala as a backup center in some stretches, and you just can't go that small against the Lakers. Like, I understand contrasting styles, but you can't give up that much size. They'll just crush you on the glass. They'll crush you underneath. You just can't have that. So I think adding Bam back into the fray, that pushes Myers or Kelly into that backup five role. Or if you want to play all three, you can probably do that. If they want to upsize a bit, go with a Bam, Kelly Olynyk front court, or what they did in the regular season, which was Bam and Myers Leonard. Then either way, you have an actual center as your backup five. And I think that kind of helps solidify the rotation a bit.
Well, that's the question I want to ask, because I feel like every immigrant dad is always asking me, you know, they used to love saying, why don't you play Bam and Whiteside together? You know, why aren't you playing Bam and Kelly Olynyk together? I'm like, the NBA doesn't work like that anymore, man. But in this series, if there ever were a time for it, just because of how giant the Lakers are and the fact that Kelly can shoot, could you foresee them playing together? In your mind, do you have an idea of how that would work in this series in particular?
Yes, I can see it. It's going to depend on Bam's health, obviously, to see if he's going to be on the floor at all, but also just how he can hold up physically against an Anthony Davis. Because if you're playing those two bigs together, that means the Lakers are playing two of their bigs together, and in which case, then you're trying to decide, okay, do you want to have Bam on Dwight Howard? just so he can kind of roam around a little bit. Dwight's probably, he's going to set screens or hang around the dunker spot so Bam can be around the rim to help rebound. Or if you're that terrified of Anthony Davis torturing you, do you put Bam on Anthony Davis and have Kelly Olynyk trying to box out and do other things to keep Dwight Howard or whoever's playing center off the glass? So if Bam's healthy, you can kind of toggle between either of those things and be comfortable.
Yeah, it would be interesting. I still think one big is probably their better bet. You know, I like you mentioned, I think Crowder after game one kind of had a better idea of what he needed to do with mm-hmm. Anthony Davis. I still think fronting him is going to be Miami's best bet. You know, for a couple reasons, I would be a little skeptical of that Bam Kelly lineup, if only because, you know, Bam is a great option one-on-one against AD. You know, the more you do it, the more you risk him getting into foul trouble. And we're also, I think, both a little nervous about what his effectiveness could be coming back from injury. Kelly, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that he picks up AD one-on-one quite often, even when he's in the game. I think Crowder is still kind of their primary matchup there. So yeah. I'd be really interested in how that one worked. You know, if Spo decided to go with it, now, granted, Spo seemingly can make anything work. So
this is also true.
Yeah, just sprinkle some Spo dust on it. How do you feel about the series? You know, everything we just talked about, the counters the Heat made in game three, the potential counters we might see in game four. Assuming Bam is back, because I really think he's going to play in game four, I don't think that game three changed it. I don't think that the Lakers are necessarily in trouble, as Jimmy and LeBron were kind of talking about there. But what's your outlook now headed into game four?
It's definitely a little bit better than it was after game two. That's for sure. But it kind of goes either way, because mm-hmm. the Heat won this game behind a ridiculous game from Jimmy Butler, but they still haven't really gotten much from their primary shooters. Mm-hmm. And that's, first, that's a testament to the Lakers' perimeter defenders. Coming into the series, I picked the Heat in six coming into the series. One of the reasons why I said that was that I felt like the Heat shooter would have a better opportunity to go off than they had in either of the previous two series. You know, Milwaukee plays their drop defense, but you have Chris Middleton, you have Wes Matthews, you have Dante DiVincenzo, you have Eric Bledsoe. All of those guys are ridiculous at chasing guys over screens and staying attached. Boston has, you know, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum and Marcus Smart, great perimeter defenders that can chase guys over screens. The Lakers had Danny Green and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, and while they're good, they aren't those guys. So I felt like, you know, the Heat shooter, this would be the opportunity for them to finally explode. And to my surprise, like, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope has been fantastic. Danny Green, he's dealing with an injury, but he's been good on that end. So Duncan Robinson hasn't been able to shake free at all. Tyler Hero has been very up and down within games. So it's been kind of tough for him to get going.
The Lakers, to their credit, have been so physical, and their length really seems to be bothering the Heat shooters to the point where even when they do get open looks, I think they're so out of rhythm. You know, Duncan missed some great looks in game three, and I think part of it is just he's been so out of rhythm. You know, credit to both sides. Credit to the Lakers for disrupting Robinson and Hero. I think credit goes to Duncan and Tyler also for maintaining their focus even when their shots aren't falling on both ends of the floor. I think Duncan got a layup yesterday. It was his first bucket, mm-hmm. Which it doesn't happen. So they're still finding ways to be effective. I'm with you there. One thing that I think is hanging over this series is just the Lakers basically shooting even with Miami from three shouldn't be happening. Like Markieff right. Morris hitting five threes or Kuzma going off. Again, big credit to those guys. All playoffs now, I've been the idiot on the podcast saying there's no way the Lakers can keep doing this. And then every game they continue to hit threes and make me eat my words.
Right.
But that is like the one thing that I think hanging over the series is what's going to happen if the Heat shooters catch fire and the Lakers shooters shoot like how they've been shooting for most of their careers.
Yeah, that's where you start to feel some optimism if you're a Heat guy, if you're a Heat fan. Because from there, as you mentioned, like the Heat already haven't had issues scoring just in general. Like the offensive ratings have been high. They've had to work a little bit harder for their looks without Bam kind of facilitating on the high elbow, but they're still getting good looks ultimately. So now if you're in a position to where the shooters are hitting shots, especially with a more engaged and aggressive Jimmy Butler attacking the basket, that's going to put a lot of strain on the Lakers. And if you're putting the Lakers into a half-court game, that's not their strong suit. They've been better this postseason than they were in the regular season, which the bar is the floor in that regard. But if you're putting the Lakers in a half-court game and you're not turning it over and you're just kind of making them grind out possessions, the Heat have shown like what the blueprint is. We're going to send Anthony Davis to his left. We're going to hedge and recover against LeBron. We're going to duck under his screens, make him shoot jumpers. And if all else fails, we'll send a late double and dare these role players to hit shots. If they go cold and the Heat are able to get into their early offense stuff and get going, that is a scary proposition for the Lakers.
Awesome. Well, we'll have to see what happens in game four. I'm sure we're both really looking forward to it. Nikias, again, if you're listening to this and you want to know game to game why something happened, the adjustments the coach has made, I highly recommend you check out Nikias's work on the Basketball News. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, man. We really appreciate it.
No problem, man. Thanks for having me on.